Hi, folks. You're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. We need your help. We need your help, folks. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you something in return. Yeah, we need your support. Become a member of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast today. You'll get the full show without commercials. You'll get full access to 10 years worth of archives. You're missing interviews every day. You're missing news analysis. And when you become a member, you help us continue to produce this show. Head over to ROFpodcast.com. I know you've been thinking about doing it. Well, today's the day. We need your help. ROFpodcast.com. ROFpodcast.com. Kick it into high gear, folks. Come on. Thanks for listening. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. On today's show, the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants, Sarah Nelson, will join us to discuss why her union was so instrumental in the government shutdown. We'll talk of some of the big battles she's fighting right now that affect us all when we fly. Jeff Hauser from the Revolving Door Project will be here to discuss how the Democrats are doing since taking over the House. And where has all the Democratic mobilization gone? Voting rights expert Ari Berman on two big cases regarding gerrymandering heading to the U.S. Supreme Court. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will join me to discuss the biggest news stories from the week. And The Atlantic's Yasmin Saran will attempt to explain Brexit to us. If you're new to the show, you can find the free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever your podcasts are found. And if you like the show, support Ring of Fire Radio by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio program commercial-free. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up now. Here to run down the biggest stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, of course, the big news, which actually happened really over last weekend, and we had really no sense of any of it as of last Friday, when I think at about 6 p.m. or so, Robert Mueller wrapped up his investigation, delivered the Mueller report to the Attorney General. And basically, all we know from the report at this point is about two sentences, or really, I guess more technically speaking, two sentence fragments. The most important thing that we know, or the most definitive thing we know at this point, is that Robert Mueller will not be bringing any more indictments. There are no more indictments. There are no more arrests associated with the specific investigation of anyone from the Trump campaign working with anyone from the Russian government on the, the endeavor of influencing the election. We know from the letter that Attorney General Barr put out, to the extent that, you know, we can know anything from that letter, but to the extent that if we take that letter at face value, we know that Robert Mueller found that there was interference in the U.S. election by the Russians. Frankly, we sort of knew that, and I don't think it's terribly surprising that they would do this. We don't know how much it influenced the election, but we know that they engaged in influencing the election. And according to what we know from the letter issued by the Attorney General, there will be no more criminal indictments associated with that. That doesn't mean there's no evidence. It's just that to the extent that there was evidence, maybe there was no evidence. We have no idea. But to the extent that there was evidence, it did not meet a threshold. Generally, most prosecutors will say they need 85% to the, and I don't know how they measure that, 85% assuredness that a that they can prove that a crime was committed. I would imagine that threshold's much higher when you're talking about the president. And we also know that Robert Mueller was under basically at the instruction of the Department of Justice that a president can't be indicted. So it would have had to have been other players, and you would have probably need a very high threshold for that as well. So that's where we are, and we're waiting to see if we're going to see the report in any, you know, reasonable facsimile as to what the report said.
Well, that's absolutely right. And that's one of the big questions I still have here is, you know, it's not even a question, really. I know the answer to it, so I'm not questioning it. Barr did not have to issue that letter the way that he did. Right. I mean, they got the report last Friday, and they decided that they had to issue some kind of principal conclusions instantly. And so they took 48 hours. They put together that letter, which was a very terse and short letter, just saying what they had decided were the principal conclusions. I think it's clear that we don't know what Robert Mueller's principal conclusions about any of this were. This is what Barr decided, apparently with the help of Rod Rosenstein, the assistant attorney general. What strikes me about that is that the only way that letter can be seen as anything but a political document, looking at what is in it and the fact that, as you point out, they only quoted Mueller himself very sparsely and in a way that raises more questions than it answers, because, you know, they didn't quote whole sentences. He just, you know, plucked out little pieces of certain sentences to sort of back up what he was saying. And so all it does is make you wonder what else, you know, what was he saying before it got to that in the sentence, right? I mean, this just it just begs for more information.
Right.
And, you know, obviously he did this to try and get to set the narrative coming out of this, that the president had been exonerated on the collusion and that Barr himself had determined that he had been exonerated on the obstruction of justice. Well, there was no reason that they had to do it that way. It's a political document, and it should have been seen that way by everyone. Barr was perfectly within his rights to say, hey, look, I need to take a week here. This is a big thing. I got to digest it. And he could have pulled out big chunks and sections of the report, even if they were redacted or whatever, to back up, you know, with evidence what this was saying. He could have, you know, said, hey, look, I'm not going to give anything. I got to look at this thing. I'm not going to tell you what's in it until I know for sure. All of that would have lent the whole exercise credibility, because it would have said, you know, look, we're going to be very careful here. Instead, he just sort of, you know, vomits out this four-page political, you know, PR document, which I think has left, you know, most people who were thinking about this get unsatisfied. And it gave, of course, it set a narrative for Trump and his enablers. And unfortunately, the media has gone for it hook, line, and sinker, and has decided to sort of run with that. I can't tell you how many times people are saying, well, the Mueller report said this and the Mueller report said that, and, you know, actually conflating that with Barr's letter, which is, of course, what the whole point was. They wanted to be able to say, look, this whole thing's over. He was cleared, and all of you who are still asking questions are just a bunch of nitpickers, and you're all just, you know, sitting there, you refuse, you won't let it go. I mean, you know, and, you know, of course, you know, we're all going to have to sit there and listen to that. It's not true. We don't know what the report says, and we may not, you know, for a long time. And what we finally get from Mueller or from Barr, you know, the longer what they're calling a summary, the longer summary may be unsatisfying. But at the very least, I would have hoped that the media would, you know, present this letter as for what it is, which was definitely a political document. It is not anything on any legal that you can accept on a legal basis or on a political basis for anyone but the true believers. And yet, you know, we're sort of stuck here in this holding pattern for the moment. So, you know, aside from the substance, I just wanted to say that, you know, I really think it's important that we keep the Barr letter in perspective for what it really is, what it was clearly designed to do, and, you know, hold our fire until we hear more.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I think the failure, it seems to me, of the media, and there's certainly, I think, without a doubt, some elements of the media that got out in front of this story more so than perhaps it warranted. Of course, the allure of ratings, I think, drove some of this. But, you know, people have to remember, this investigation started way before Donald Trump was president of the United States. It started in the context of a national security investigation. It was not criminal until, I think, months after after it began, and I think after even the president became president. And it, I'm not quite sure what the option was. Now, there were a lot of people, to be, you know, to be frank, who went on, made careers for themselves in some respects out of, you know, pontificating about something that they didn't necessarily know about. But the investigation has gone on. The irony is, of course, people continue to do that now, and we still don't know what's in that report. Like, we have, you know, some, maybe an inkling of a shadow of it. But throughout this process, it's been a political process because, according to the Department of Justice, a sitting president cannot be indicted. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about this a little bit more. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio, talking to the great Digby. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, we're talking about the Mueller report, but there is no Mueller report. We're talking about the sort of the shadow of the Mueller report, and we don't even know if it's an accurate shadow. It is a summation of, and do we know the size of it, of the report?
No.
How big it is? It could be a 5-page document. It could be a 500-page document. All we know is a 4-page letter that has a couple of phrases from the report commingled with an interpretation of that report by an attorney general who was known as the fixer for the Iran-Contra affair under George Herbert Walker Bush, by an attorney general who, and we'll talk about this perhaps in the next hour, who, according to reports, was simply overruled by the White House as to the Justice Department's stance on the Affordable Care Act in the Fifth Circuit. Now, so the relationship between the president and this attorney general is an interesting one, to say the least. But all right, so your thoughts here. So we know from the letter, at least, that Attorney General Barr, that there is no indictments that we can expect from this question of whether Trump campaign people actively engaged with Russian government people to influence the election. We know that the Russian government did influence the election, according to the report. And we know that on some level, Mueller did not make a call on obstruction, and Barr, at the least, decided that there was none based upon presumably what he read in the report. But of course, we know that he believed there was no obstruction even before he had the job. In fact, that was his job resume, an argument that there was no obstruction before he knew what was in the case. So where does that leave us? I mean, what give me just your sense of how all this went down and you know, whether you think there's some culpability within the media for hyping something that turns out to not have been as nefarious as advertised.
Well, taking the first part, I think that the way it went down, I think it's pretty, you know, pretty clear. I mean, I think that Barr was hired on the basis of that memo that he sent to the White House unsolicited, a 16-page memo, you know, four times as long as this letter that he sent out last weekend, saying that he felt that that he believed that Mueller's theory of obstruction was fatally misconceived, were the words that he used. And, you know, Trump didn't know him, but I think that that was among Trump's lawyers. They were saying, hey, man, you know, this is your guy. You know, he's the one to replace Sessions. And they knew that Sessions was going to be replaced at some point, right? I mean, they waited till after the election, but at the midterms. And this was the guy they had. And they knew that he would be able to pass muster for the Senate and that he would be able to get in there. And this was apparently, according to what everything that we've read, that what Trump's lawyers were truly concerned about was the fact that Trump had blatantly obstructed justice. And we've seen it. I mean, this is not hidden. We know he obstructed justice on his Twitter feed, right? He's dangling pardons. He's calling people rats. He's demeaning the attorney general and saying that he shouldn't have recused. I mean, this goes on and on and on. And then there's stuff, even according to Barr, that we don't know about Trump's obstruction. So this was clearly his biggest danger as far as the lawyers were concerned, because it was, I think it was likely that there's way more evidence than not that's what he did. Now, it's a hard thing to prove because of intent. You have to be able to do that, and I think that Mueller, for some reason, which will need to be explained, felt that he couldn't personally interview the president, which, who knows? I mean, Trump would have lied, of course, and his lawyers knew that, and that's probably why they wouldn't let him be interviewed. But what that would have proven, I don't know. Nonetheless, you know, that was obviously a big part of this, and I think that Mueller, nobody knows why Mueller, you know, punted to the Justice Department on making the decision. But the most logical thing to me, most people who know him and they've been talking on TV say, you know, it's really not like him. He's not afraid to make the hard decisions. It's just not, you know, and that's what a special counsel is supposed to do. The precedent in these situations, though, suggests that the reason that he did it, as Leon Jaworski did and as Ken Starr did, under different rules. Jaworski was under a special counsel rule, and Ken Starr was under the independent counsel rule laws statute. But both of them declined to make that obstruction charge, and instead they felt that it was a political decision, and they left it up to the political players, i.e., the Congress. Or perhaps in Mueller's case, he thought that Barr was a political player. But in any case, he felt that it was beyond his scope. And that's, I think, the best guess on what he was doing there. Especially considering you can't indict a president, right? I mean, it's like,
right.
You know, so what's the point? Why am I doing this? what was the reason that I did this if the president can't be indicted and I found evidence of his behavior? So I think, you know, my suspicion is that's why that happened. And we'll see where that goes. I mean, you know, Barr, I think, has now shown that he is a political player in this, and it's unlikely to me that this is going to go down without a fight, that there's going to be, you know, what's going to happen on the obstruction charges. The White House is going to claim executive privilege. It will have to be litigated between the Congress, and they'll go to court, and, you know, there'll be a lot of back and forth, as Nixon did with the tapes, right? It's exactly the same situation.
Right. Well,
so, you know, we'll have to see how that goes.
All right. Well, we've got to take a break. We can touch on this again in the next hour, because this question of obstruction is a fascinating one. And of course, we're a little bit stumbling around in the dark, but that is all we have been given by the U.S. Justice Department for the time being. But we got to take a break. We'll be back with more Ring of Fire. Digby will join me in the next hour. I'm Sam Cedar. Right back after this. Just ahead, we'll discuss the importance of labor during the government shutdown with the president of the Association of Flight Attendants, Sarah Nelson. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Our next guest was recently profiled in the New York Times for her work as the president of the Association of the Flight Attendants. here to discuss her role and why it's been such an important one lately, Sarah Nelson. So, Sarah, very happy to have you on the program. Wanted to talk to you really since the resolution of the government shutdown. I happen to believe that the biggest untold story of the government shutdown is the role of labor in ending that shutdown, and specifically your union in that context. But before we get into that story, the TikTok of that, and then I also want to talk to you about the latest action you folks are taking in regards to Frontier and more broadly the union movement in this country. Just tell us, give us some of the basic facts of the flight attendant union in this country.
Sure. The Association of Flight Attendants represents 50,000 flight attendants across 20 different airlines. We were founded in 1945, had the first contract in 1946 at United Airlines. And we have worked over the years to beat back all the discriminatory practices that tried to keep this as a job, had young women have to leave the profession if they turned age 30, if they got married, if they got pregnant. We had to step on a weight scale until 1993. And of course, originally it was only a job for women. So we also had to fight for the rights of men to have the same rights as women on the job. And that is our history. Today, what we're doing is representing people from all genders, races, cultures, and creeds who make up the flight attendant profession. Anyone with the heart of a flight attendant can have this as their chosen career. And we fight for economic justice on the job, and we fight for safety for our members and for the traveling public.
And I imagine I can only imagine having just had experience, obviously, flying and seeing my fellow passengers that it's a trying position at times. I imagine that requires some support in the context of dealing with management.
Well, look, we wouldn't have this career if it wasn't for our union. We wouldn't have many of the safety regulations if it wasn't for our union. We fought for clean water on the planes. We fought for the FDA inspection of our food on the planes. We fought for clean air. We got rid of smoking on the planes. These were all the actions of our flight attendant union. None of this was initiated by management. In some cases, we brought them to our way of thinking. But none of this would have happened if it wasn't for our flight attendant union.
All right. So let's talk about your union in the context of the government shutdown. I think there was a lot of folks who were saying over the course of the shutdown that we weren't really going to see any type of movement, frankly, until we started to see problems in air travel. Before you get into the role that labor play, why do you think it is that air travel in particular has the ability to make people more conscious of what the government does?
Well, look, everybody is connected to air travel. And you can just think about this. If you were alive on 9/11 and the days immediately following that, everyone would say that they could remember the quietness of the skies and how strange that was. That we're all used to looking up at different places all over the country and seeing planes in the skies. And our air transportation system is really what connects our entire country. It's how we move the vast majority of our mail and services and goods. And it is what people think of as their connection to their loved ones or to getting to the important business meeting or to celebrating a marriage or to remember those that we love when they've passed. And so this is really what connects all of us. And it is a common denominator across genders, races, cultures, and creeds. It is a microcosm of America on every single one of those metal tubes that goes up in the air every day.
So, all right. So walk us through this, because there was a lot of people who felt that what we were going to see is that we're looking to our specifically to the air traffic controllers specifically as the sort of the pivot point of the stability of air travel. And in some ways, it ended up being the air traffic air controllers, but it ended up being the TSA folks and you folks who sort of, I guess, ratcheted up. Tell me about the dynamic of how this, because on the I remember that morning, it was a Friday morning where there was reports that LaGuardia had been shut down for an hour, that I think it was in Philadelphia, in Miami. And I mean, at that moment, it was clear that it was just a matter of time, and it ended up being literally just a matter of hours. But give me the sense of the dynamic, the interplay between those different constituencies who were able to put pressure on airline travel.
Sure. Well, first of all, airline travel doesn't happen without an incredible public and private partnership. The federal government is so completely intertwined with the private business of the airlines that one cannot function without the other. And so anytime there's a government shutdown, we have opposed that. We have expressed concern. It has an impact on safety and security. If you start having people come to work and telling them that they're not going to get paid, that has an impact and a distraction on safety. I learn in my flight attendant training every year, the very first thing we learn is that when you're doing safety-sensitive work, you remove all distractions. Any distraction can cause a disruption to safety. So not paying people is a very, very acute distraction, and it really created an unsafe space. The other thing that it did was it stopped all of the infrastructure planning and the programs that help support safety and security. So anything that was in process to improve the safety and security, or to upgrade it, or to update it, or to fill in staffing behind of people who are leaving in the normal course of the operation, retirements or medical leaves or what have you, none of that was happening. And so every single day that the shutdown went on, those safety nets that we have, the layers of safety and security that are there that keep us safe, were getting stretched further and further. And it was creating holes, and it was creating the possibility of a catastrophic incident. And so every single day that that happened, we became more and more concerned as flight attendants. And as federal workers, they not only do not have the right to strike, but as we learned from PATCO in 1981, those strikers can actually be federally prosecuted. They can even lose their freedom, not to mention losing the right to have their job or to return to work in any government position. So those labor laws are really abysmal. And if you think about it, in private business, no one would go to work without getting paid or being told that they're not going to get paid. That would end on day one. For the 2 million people who either went without work or without pay, they would have been given a warn notice of at least 60 days and been able to plan for that. None of that happened. But under federal labor law, these workers didn't have the right to strike. And so it really required defining for the public what was at stake. And when you say there wasn't really any action, or a lot of people said there wasn't going to be action until this was affecting air travel, what that really means is that air travel is something that can affect every single person's self-interest. And they can relate to that, and they can be concerned about stopping air travel. And so that is where our politics converge. That is where our interests converge. And what we did, spent a lot of time with the air traffic controllers and with the transportation security officers and with the pilots doing in a partnership between public and private unions, is we defined for the public what was at stake here. And the air traffic controllers could only do this job for so long without having those distractions be such a stressor on them that they medically could not do that work. And what we told the public was, in any other job, if you do your job at 99.5% rate of efficiency, you are stellar. You are going to get awards. And if the air traffic controllers come to work and they have a 99.5% effective day, that means 50 airplanes go down that day. Right. So this, there was a lot at stake here, and we had to define that. And so a week before the flight started to stop at LaGuardia, our union also started to stand up and say, look, we have got to understand really what's at stake here. And we need to talk about a general strike, because if Washington isn't going to do their job, these people are going to continue to follow through on the oath that they've given to this country and go to work and perform these safety and security functions. But the same people that they report to are not going to do their job to make sure that they have the pay and the support and the systems up and running to support the work that they're doing, then we've got to step up and stop everything and make Washington do its job. So we had been calling for a general strike. Our union had been preparing to withhold our service because we were getting to a place where this was just simply unsafe to be on planes. And we were very loud about that. And the air traffic controllers were really only doing what was within their rights after right. defining it so clearly for the American public. And we got the attention because we were able to, as a private union, talk about the fact that we were not going to continue to go to work under those conditions.
All right. Well, Sarah Nelson, we've got to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk more about the union movement more broadly. And if we are seeing in this country a renewed sense that workers have more power than they have contemplated in the past, and withholding their labor can promote benefits for the entire society. Also want to talk about what's happening with Frontier Air. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking to the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants, Sarah Nelson. So, Sarah, in the last segment, you basically walked us through the more or less the TikTok that I believe was. And there was a lot of credit for, you know, the Democratic politicians holding the caucus together, not caving on the government shutdown. But when you issued a press release basically saying on that Friday as the head of the flight attendants union, Mitch McConnell, I hope you can hear us now. Something to that effect. I'm paraphrasing.
Do we have your attention now?
Do we have your attention now? And you did. And quickly things turned around. The government reopened. And when I think there were threats coming from Donald Trump and the Republican Party to shut it down again, you folks were out there again saying we are prepared not to waste any time this time around. So let me ask you this in that context. Do you sense, I mean, you know, this your union's action comes in the wake of a lot of strikes that have been happening in the education sector. We have seen teachers' unions and teachers' associations flex the muscle of labor in this country in a way we haven't seen, I think, it really, I mean, in such a broad way in decades. I've had the opportunity to talk to teachers' union heads who all told me to a person, we're going to use this power more. We didn't realize really in many respects that we had it. And we left this power too dormant. Do you have a sense that there's something changing in the way that labor perceives itself in this country?
Well, I think whether labor gets it or not, the average American has had enough. The rubber band is breaking all over the country. And you take those teacher strikes, for example, you know, the teachers have the support of their entire communities. That's because everything centers around education. If there's not good education in your school district, the businesses that we're trying to attract to that area are not going to want to come because they are going to do an assessment of whether or not the employees that they have can put their kids into good schools. Everything is connected. And what we're starting to see is that there is a commonality in the experience of the American worker, whether it is a public or private job. Pensions have been gutted, and there is a continued attack on the remaining pensions. There has been more and more move to Wall Street instead of reinvesting in companies and working for the good of those companies to succeed and sharing in the success with the employees. More and more is given in stock buybacks to Wall Street. And in executive bonuses. And this is the same narrative happening across the country. You see that right now there's an attack on healthcare and an inability to have even a conversation about climate change and how that's affecting all of us. And People are sick and tired of Washington not working, of Wall Street trying to take all of the profits and productivity that this American, the American workers are turning out. And people are seeing a commonality here. And the old tactics of dividing people through racism and sexism, people are starting to wise up and see that those really were bosses' tactics. And we have to come together as workers and stand up and use our power, because we do have power. You know, when I first started talking about our union withholding our service, the first question I got was, well, what are the pilots going to do? Well, that was maybe a sexist question. It was maybe an idea that only some workers have power, or some workers have more power than others. And in a very short time, that question went away. And, you know, mad respect for my friends in the flight deck, and we coordinated a lot of work on this. But the reality is that flight attendants had enough power to shut the system down, and people started to realize that. And so workers have incredible power when they come together and exercise that power together. And in a time when that can also be recognized by the public as part of something for the public good, we're in a good position to exercise that power as workers and fight for our country, fight for our democracy, fight for good health care, fight for good green jobs with good labor protections and good jobs for people, not just green. We can really make some strides here, and workers can flex their muscle to really fix what's wrong with this country.
You know, I think the biggest change I think that I think we're seeing in the union movement is that union leaders like yourself are talking about issues that are not specific to your union members, that ones that are shared across the community. But with that said, we got 2 minutes left, so I want to hear also about what's happening in terms of Frontier. This is an airline which seems to have consistently underpaid its flight staff. What's happening with just about a minute and a half left here? What's happening on that front?
Yeah, so Frontier, we were successful in getting a contract, and we were successful because Frontier flight attendants turned out a 99% strike vote, and they were out there picketing and making it very clear that they were willing to make good on that strike vote. And we were able to negotiate a contract, the terms of which are not going to be released until later this week, but that will be life-changing and dramatically improve the pay, the working conditions, and the benefits for Frontier flight attendants. And this is going to finally make Frontier pay when they have pocketed massive profits off the flight attendants' backs for years based on a bankruptcy and an inability to a refusal to get to the table and negotiate terms that were competitive with the rest of the industry. So we just made them pay by flight attendants standing up and saying that they were willing to use their power together to fight back.
We just have about 30 seconds left, but I'm curious, when you as a union leader, when you have a successful a threat of a strike and it turns out this successful, what does it do for the rest of the union in terms of loading for bear for the next fight?
Well, look, you know, sometimes you have to beat it out of them. Sometimes they have to just remember the beating they're going to take if they don't deal with you fairly. And what we find is that with power comes respect. So when we have been successful in our strike action, what we have seen is a respect that comes from management and an ability to work together better than ever before. And that's the result. When you stand together and you use your power, you're going to get results, and you're going to have them remember what happens if they step out of line.
Sarah Nelson, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sarah Nelson is the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, AFL-CIO. United Airlines flight attendants since 1996. Today, the AFA-CWA represents nearly 50,000 flight attendants at 20 different airlines across the country. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to hear what you've been missing.